Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How do you save a Premier League penalty? Well, we've got two of the three greatest of all time to explain it to us. So much to talk about on this week's episode of the Gangapod as we also look towards Chelsea against Manchester City and Arsenal against Tottenham. Let's get started. Yeah, hi everyone. Another big week of the Premier League to review. And how about it? We thought it would be close this season. And five match weeks in, Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester United all level on 13 points. Chelsea and Liverpool, well, you have to go down to an away goal by Chelsea at Anfield to get the Blues on the top of the table at this stage of the season. And the beauty is, as we talk about match week five on this week's episode of the Gangapod, we are leading into a weekend that has Chelsea against Manchester City to kick us off on Saturday night. So much to talk about. David Wiener with you once again to do so, joined by Michael Bridges, Thomas Sorensen, Mark Schwarzer to do it. Gents, how are we all? Bridgie to you, because you're in my top left corner, so I'll start with you at the top of our Zoom. How are you, mate?
I'm absolutely fantastic this morning, Dave. I'm pleased that we weren't doing the Gegenpod yesterday, because I would have been a very, very depressed man after Tottenham got absolutely flogged by Chelsea. But I tell you what, loads to talk about. The weekend of action that was, and the weekend that is coming up is going to be sensational. More London derbies to talk about.
I tell you what, indeed. And I know we've been excited over the last 5 weeks or so, Thomas, but it's all coming to life, isn't it?
Yeah, that's shaping up. And, you know, who's going to stop Chelsea? I think that's, you know, I can see the smile on your face. You know, they like Bridgie said.
We're lucky we didn't do this podcast this time yesterday morning.
Yeah, especially in the second half, they destroyed Tottenham. So, you know, there's so many games to look forward to. And as you say, Bridgie, London Derby as well at the weekend. So, yeah, can't wait.
Mark, entertain us. What's going on in Europe? What do you got for us on the side of the world that's doing things?
Well, Barcelona just equalised the last minute of the game. Can you believe it? They were having a horror run at home to Granada. So what's happening? That's obviously the news here in Spain, how bad they've been and how they look horrendous. And obviously still gloating over Chelsea, beat that other team. What are they called? They are in a sorry state, aren't they? Let's be honest. It's all gone pear-shaped for Bridgie's favourite first team. What are they called? Tottenham, that's it.
The nickname starts with an S. And it's not shite, as it should be.
Because they are having one, aren't they? I mean, all the stories obviously started about Harry Kane and how he then apparently looked disinterested towards the end of the game. And, of course, all the troubles that are happening at Man City in terms of not being able to score. And obviously, two and two have been linked together again. And the question will be in January, if it continues, will City go back in for Kane? And the other thing would be, will Tottenham then be prepared to sell him and try and get as much money as they can? And will they get anywhere near what they were supposedly offered just now in the summer?
Doesn't go away. Storylines of the Premier League. We will kick on with that shortly. We're going to start off we're recording on Tuesday morning, Australian Eastern Standard Time. That's when the Gegenpod is recording this week. So we're going to just kick off with some news just in overnight for our audience. And the first one is a bit of feel-good news for Australian football, with the news that Jared Gillett, the referee, who's gone over to the UK after his impressive stint here in the A-League, he's gone and joined the referees group over in the UK, broken through, been in the Championship, been in the VAR box, and on the weekend he will officiate Watford against Newcastle United in the Premier League. He will be the first overseas official, Schwartzy, in the Premier League. And I know there aren't any Australian players in the Premier League right now, but irrespective of that, this is an outstanding achievement and a really great milestone for you'd have to say another type of trailblazer in Australian football.
Absolutely. There is a debate whether or not he is the first non-British or non-British referee, because Dermot Gallagher was actually born in Ireland at the age of 16, moved across the UK, but was registered with the English FA and represented England. So therefore, they class him as English. Minor technicality, but I tell you what, absolutely amazing accomplishment from Jared Gillett to be the first Aussie, of course, let's say it that way, first Aussie to referee in a Premier League referee abroad like that. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty exciting, I have to say. I'm excited to see how he does, and I hope he does really, really well.
We talk about we've always talked about as players, the tyranny of distance to get abroad, but actually to cut through it in a profession that hasn't had that lineage before, Bridgie, especially for someone who's you've come here in the A-League as well, you've come back down here. It's a heck of a not just an achievement, but actually ambition to head over there and try cut through in a market where no one's really done that before.
Yeah, I think you've got to credit him for what he's done. And, you know, I look back to the ICC Cup that was on in Melbourne, and I remember that they got Clattenburg to come over and do a masterclass in refereeing, and he took Gillett under his wing, and I think he was suitably impressed, and I think that has been the mentoring that has gone on there, and he's really, really helped him to take the gamble and look to go overseas and get more opportunities. And I think Clattenburg's helped him a hell of a lot, but obviously you've got to go and spread your wings and be by yourself, and he's done it in the Championship. The VR have been impressed them, and he's impressed everybody out there, so that's fair credit to him. And what he's done now, he's actually set a pathway. There's a lot of kids in Australia at this moment in time are going through their refereeing course, and we've managed at my son's playing at Cooks Hill in the Newcastle region, and what they've done, they've got all the kids to go online and do their courses as early as they can, even though they're players as well. So they gain more respect for the referees when they are actually playing their games, because they've got to referee the matches, and they get paid by the clubs now for the matches that they referee. And I think it's a really, really good presence that they've set to get respect across the whole board. And that's a really, really good thing now, that kids can see that if they don't make it as footballers, they can go on and be referees and referee games to make some money and obviously have a career from it.
For all your listeners out there, just in case you didn't understand, Bridgie, it's Cooks Hill. Okay, so not Kooks Hill, just wanted to say.
We've got Kook Books.
Very good, very good. Tom, did you ever get refereed by Jared?
I did, yes.
Yeah, no, Bridgie, you did.
Oh, sorry, I thought I didn't realise who you're talking to there, Dave. Well, I didn't. I had one game with him where he had a shock and one game where he was very good. Tommy?
Yeah, no, I had huge respect for him when I had him in the A-League. I thought he stood out as definitely the best referee that was there. And I like what he's done. I think, you know, a little bit like the women's game now, young girls can see the pathway. They can see a pathway to, yeah, to making money, to make a career out of it. And now you can in refereeing as well here in Australia. And, you know, I like that he's gone for it. He's obviously, you know, he's made his connections. He's put his name in the hat and he's worked hard for it. He's done it the hard way. He hasn't been handed it to him. So, you know, fair play. And I think like my Swartzy said, I wish him all the best. I think you would hope that he has a good first game and cements himself.
Yeah, indeed. His game management, his personality is what they say is what stood out, that he had a good rapport with all the players. Seems like that was one of the reasons he was very, very popular amongst the players here in the A-League. And he's got some experience of big games. He took charge in the Championship playoffs last season. He's done EFL Cup games, obviously Championship games, been in the VAR box. So all the very best to him on the weekend. So from good news to the game, guys, to not such good news overnight for Australian football with Harry Kewell. He's been sacked by Barnett after just 7 games in charge of the National League club. That's 7 games, no wins. The club said in a statement through their head of football, Dean Brennan, it was clear how much Harry Kewell wanted to have a positive impact. But ultimately, the results and the poor start to the season have dictated our decision. The plan for the season was for Barnett FC to be challenging in the top half of the table, and that is still very much our aim. Not great news for Kewell Schwartzy, who now has Barnett joining a list of clubs, Notts County, Oldham and Crawley Town, where it hasn't quite worked out for him.
I mean, Crawley Town, I wouldn't put it down as not working out for him. I actually think it worked out really well for him as he chose to leave. It was a decision, I think, obviously in hindsight. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. He probably regrets a little bit, but then the opportunity to join Notts County at the time was too great. It's tough, isn't it? Really, really tough for anyone in management. And I think for Harry, I remember when I interviewed him when he was at Crawley Town and I asked him why Crawley Town. He said it was the only offer he had. And then I think it's kind of pretty much probably been the same thing as the list of clubs have gone on. And Barnett was another opportunity at a club where the owners are pretty trigger happy, but then saying that 7 games in, not winning a single game, it's tough. I did speak to Harry a couple of weeks ago and he was saying that, you know, it's tough at that level because there's quite a few clubs that have money. They've thrown money around. his team, for example, he said in this level, he goes, you very rarely be able to keep a team together for longer than 12 months. He was sort of kind of having to rebuild again. And his own personal goal was to finish in the top half of the table, not necessarily the teams. And so it's a bit strange to hear the club come out and make a statement saying that we want to be in the top half of the table contesting for potentially a playoff position when Harry was saying his own goal was just to finish in the top half of the table.
Bridgie, you know Harry very well, obviously. This is another setback. What do you think happens now to him with his managerial ambitions?
Well, it's going to be very tough. Like Swartzy said, I think if there's one thing that he has learnt, when he left Corley and he went to Notts County, he went with a trigger-happy owner. And, you know, the writing was on the wall early doors. Harry got sacked from there in his short career. Barnet had that as well with their history with their owner. I thought you might have learnt a lesson. And all you could see on the, you know, a lot of the messages that have been coming back in from the club said, oh, here we go again, another manager, X, Y, and Z. So I do feel from that respect. But where's he going to go from here? Yeah, Dave, that is an unbelievable question, because if you're not doing it at three or four clubs in the lower divisions, it's very unlikely you're going to get another sniff anywhere higher. So if he does want to continue his coaching career and the managerial career, that he's worked so hard in taking a big leap of faith in certain opportunities that he's gone for, I think he's got to look overseas, and wherever that might be, we don't know. He's a family man. He enjoys his spending time with his family. He obviously loves his coaching, and to relax, he plays golf. So where does he go? I honestly don't know. I think the lower leagues, he's going to be very, very lucky to get another opportunity. I hope he does, and I hope he gets somewhere where he can actually put a plan in progress. Like Swartzy said, he hasn't been given that time. And when he did at Corley, he had very good success. So I wouldn't write Harry off. He loves it when everything is against him. He will bounce back in some form, and we will see him back in the managerial hot seat, I would say, in the next 6 months, definitely. But I would say overseas.
Well, it is a brutal world down there in the lower leagues of English football. So he's certainly had some tough gigs down there to begin. We wish him well, and we hope we see him again back in the managerial dugout some point soon. Now, gents, we're going to talk about everything that happened the weekend. I'm going to save Chelsea Tottenham. Would you believe it? I'm not going to open up with that, but mainly because there's so much to talk about that in light of the huge fixtures that are coming up next week as well. So before we get too carried away, I want to start with something still fresh off the weekend. It was huge drama. I mean, probably the most bonkers end to a game we've had so far this season, where Manchester United did end up edging West Ham. But that was courtesy, of course, of David De Gea's last second save off Mark Noble coming off the bench. David Moyes ushering him off the bench to find the equaliser after Jesse Lingard's exceptional goal to put Manchester United ahead. Just in uttering that sentence, Thomas, that pretty much sums up the ultimate drama that the Premier League can dish out.
Yeah. I think many of us couldn't quite believe it. You understand the logic behind it. Like, you got your player, statistically, he's the best that you have at penalties, but it's just not that simple. Because if it was, I think De Gea should have been substituted, because his record is probably the worst in Europe at saving penalties. But, you know, again, to come on as a player who hasn't touched the ball, we saw it, at the Euros, didn't work. There's, that statistic goes out the window, because another thing takes over, and that's the pressure, the emotions, your doubts. You haven't touched the ball for any length of time. And, it's just not that easy. And we saw it. It was a poor penalty. It was, had the gear. He went the right way, and he would save it. And he did. So fair play to him for stepping up after a lot of criticism, especially in the Europa League final, last year, where he didn't save anything. It was important. And United dug out a big win, because, West Ham really, took them to the wire.
Dave, I've got to say, I was absolutely delighted that Manchester United ended up getting the result in this game, because there was a couple of moments in that game where I could not believe Cristiano Ronaldo was not given a penalty. Just the one out of the two. I don't think they could have, one of them was a little bit of a dodgy coming together, but he had to get one of them. I could not believe it. Even when you saw it in full speed and slow speed. So for them to get the result, I thought it was just reward.
while we're on that, and then I want to pick the keeper's brains in a second. But Jesse Lingard, I think that's a terrific story, Bridgie. A guy that was really, you know, on the out at Manchester United, has gone to West Ham, got himself back into a Euro squad. And I mean, the goal yesterday coming off the bench after his mistake midweek for England. Yeah. Like, this kid's got something about him after, I say kid, you know, he's still got a bit to prove, and he's overcoming all those obstacles now getting thrown his way, which maybe a couple of seasons ago he wasn't doing.
Yeah, and it's great to see him bounce back. I think the fresh start down at West Ham did him the world of good. He won the fans over, he won the respect of the players, and he got his career back on track, Dave, like you said. And he had a huge decision to make. It was probably taken out of his hands because Manchester United knew what a quality player he is and can be. And they saw the Jesse Lingard that we love to see back again with a new fire in his belly at West Ham, and thought he can do good things for us. We don't want to sell him. And he's been getting criticised for his celebration where he didn't celebrate that win. And I think it was just purely out of respect for how the fans had played a part in getting him back to his best. And you never know in the future what's going to happen. If he'd have gone off celebrating and thrown it in their faces, it could have cost him a move in the future going back to West Ham. And I just think everything about him, because I wasn't his biggest fan, you know. I think his body language at times at United, I didn't like his work ethic and his body language and his demeanour. But I thought that showed a lot of respect and a kind of clear headspace as to his all-round persona once again.
I always look back at a comparison to United's bench in the Europa League final, where I think they had Juan Mata, Fred, Alex Telles, Daniel James came on, and then yesterday when they needed to change the game, they had Jadon Sancho. Lingard comes on. They've got that depth that's growing, that's providing them that different hand. We've spoken about it in depth the last couple of weeks, but that was a really good snapshot of that. But they still needed Schwarzy David De Gea to step up. Before we talk about the penalty itself, De Gea himself, Solskjaer said he is a new man this season. Are you seeing a bit of a different mentality from him after a couple of different seasons? Is this just a moment that might actually just be a good line in the sand for him, this penalty save? Because Solskjaer had some big decisions to make around the goalkeepers, and he stuck with the legacy of David De Gea.
Well, I think the decision of sticking with De Gea this season has been made easy for him because Dean Henderson's been out injured. Obviously, they brought in Tom Heaton, but I don't think they ever brought Tom Heaton in to be a genuine contender as number one for Manchester United. I think they always saw him as a number two or number three as a squad player. That you need three good goalkeepers. So that decision has been taken out of Solskjaer's hands. And I think De Gea has done well. Is he back to the form he showed a couple of years ago? Not quite yet. That's going to take more time. He needs to be more consistent. Will the penalty save help him build on confidence? Absolutely. Whenever you're making saves, big saves, match-winning saves, defining moments of games because of a save, absolutely. I mean, listen, any penalty save is a really good penalty save. Doesn't matter how bad the penalty itself was taken. For a goalkeeper to go the right way, make the save, is a good save. So for De Gea, it's only a positive. And when you're on the end of saving those 3 points, you grow an extra foot in confidence.
Mr. Wiener, can I just say we are talking to penalty save goalkeeping royalty here with these two. There's an unbelievable statistic going around at the moment, Schwartzy. Please enlighten us.
Well, which one's that, mate? There's obviously top five penalty saves in the top five number of penalty saves in the Premier League. David James, number one at 13 saves. Thomas Sorensen, number two on 12. Myself, Shea Given, and Brad Friedel, all on 10.
There you go, Wiener.
I was going to throw it back to you and say we have and include you in the list, but you've thrown it back the other way. So well done, Bridgie. To you guys, you're standing in goal. You have the mentality of knowing when a penalty is coming up, you know, what you want to do, and you see someone brought in Cole Thomas off the bench. What does that do to you as a goalkeeper when you're approaching that and you are in De Gea's position on the weekend? Does that give you the sense of immediately a sense of superiority? Does that change your mentality as you approach it?
You know, just basically with penalties, I think, I used to put a lot of work into it and it paid off. And it's not just, you know, you hear a lot of people say, but it's just a 50-50, you know, dive left, dive right. You make a decision and you're lucky if you save it. There's a lot of work. You know the players. You know, he would have known Noble. So he would have seen, he probably wouldn't have been first on his list, but he would have known De Gea, the statistics of every West Ham player taking penalties before that game. And then it becomes the mental battle. There's so much you can do as a goalkeeper from a mental perspective. You look at body language, and then you take all that into account, the situation. You know, there's a difference. Like, we've all, as a goalkeeper, been in training sessions where players under no pressure, you know, they take more of a chance. You know, they leave their, you know, their tendencies. But when people come under pressure, they tend to stick to what they're good at. And that, you know, the more you practice it, you can sort of sum up that situation to your advantage. And I think De Gea did that in that situation, because you look at his body language, you could see he was nervous. You could see he was thinking it through. You know, I've been brought on to score this one. You know, that's all I have to do in this game. De Gea took full advantage.
When you say you put a lot of work, is that also in terms of the analytics of sort of their trends? And so you're actually studying the players? Is that what you mean by that?
No. So, yeah, that's part of it. I used to do movements as well. So practice, you know, diversion. You know, you can sort of try to influence players in the run-up before the kick. You know, how you position yourself, and I used to work with especially the national team coach on different tactics, different things, trying different things out to try to influence the players' minds before they were kicking it in their run up. And I think it was that last moment, because they tend to look at the keeper, and then with about one or two steps before the ball, they'll start to look down. So you have that second or two before they look down to try to influence them. And that was something we were working on. And obviously that was something that helped me.
I've got to say, it was fascinating sitting with Thomas in the studio when we were doing the Euros and the matches went to penalty shootouts, because I was fascinated at how many times Tommy got the direction of the ball from the penalty kick taker correct. And it was basically from the run-up. And, you know, there was a lot of players that we've watched, but Tommy won't study them penalty takers like he did back in the day. And I just found it interesting just by the actual angle of the run-up, what Tommy was saying. And I found that fascinating.
And before we get to Schwartz, just one other thing, Thomas, when you said under pressure, they go back to type. So is that also when you say, like, you know, when I said, your players come off the bench, you think, I've got this. If a Mark Noble's coming on, you go, he's cold. He hasn't had a kick of the ball. I know I've studied that he's gone that way 9 times out of 10. I'm going to back that he's going to go the comfortable way this time because he's coming on cold and the stakes are so high. Is that kind of where you'd sort of hedge if you were going to in that situation?
It would be part of the decision. It wouldn't be the whole decision, from my point. You know, I would also look at, from every step he's taking from when he enters the box, I would watch him. You know, how does he put the ball down? How does he step back from the ball? And then, as I said, in those couple of seconds when he starts his run-up, that's when I'll then make the decision based on all of it. You know, based on what I know from him beforehand and what I see. And then I'll make that decision.
Schwartz, you had no idea at penalties either. Have you got anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting as well, obviously, the later you got on in your career, the more technology came into it. So, you know, the analysing aspect of it, video analysis, then having separate video analysis for yourself. I mean, the one club I was at was at Chelsea, whereby as sets of goalkeepers, the goalkeeping coach would actually hold his own video analysis session on the day of a game of the opposition. And the penalty taking situation, and I don't think Petr Cech was that successful at saving penalties. He's certainly not on that list in the top five. But they would research it to the nth degree, in terms of, on some players you could actually pick up a certain movement or a certain angle they would take, and they would always go one way when they made this particular movement or this particular step, as opposed to going the other way. And that's the detail they went into. I mean, I used to watch a lot of videos as well and just study players and go, okay, right, statistically, this is how often and how far he goes. And you'll find with players, a lot of penalty takers often, they'll have a favourite corner. They'll have a go-to penalty that they'll use. I mean, I thought with Martin Noble, he made it pretty easy for David De Gea in the end because of, for me, it was pretty obvious. He telegraphed where he was going to play it. It was obvious he was going to go there. And obviously, hindsight's a wonderful thing because obviously he did go that way. I mean, if he'd whipped it, he would have gone, okay, well, he's done him well there. He's played as if he's going down that way and then he's whipped it the other way, but he didn't. So, yeah, it was all about the preparation, like Thomas was saying. You know, there were things that you would not – I wouldn't do as much on the training field. It'd be more about video analysis because a lot of the sessions you did were reflex sessions and, you know, reacting rather than preempting or knowing where the ball's going and then just making a save. So I think for me what was more important was the video analysis, having a lot of video footage, as much video footage as you possibly could of each individual penalty taker that you were potentially going to face.
Dave is a journalist. He scribbles a lot of stuff down. He normally got smoke coming off his pencil. I have never seen as much information absorbed and taken in there, thinking that he can get all of this stuff taken down so he can make that footballing goalkeeping career that he's always been after. Wiener, it's over. It's over. Stop trying to get information off the boys. You will not get in the A-League, mate. It's done.
No, I used to give away penalties just so I could save them. That was the one thing I thought I could actually do down at the park because I knew that couldn't lob me from the 6-yard spot.
My word. This is not for the listeners. This is for Dave Wiener.
Hey, George, I've heard you say in the past that you would wait to the last second. You would stay very, very still. To what extent we've seen your compatriot Thomas jump up and down, Kasper Schmeichel, wave like he's about to take off an aeroplane. You keep very still. Is that a personal sort of choice? Is that a coaching technique? Have you experimented? Did you try something different later on in your career? I'm just interested in that aspect of the positioning and that game of what's that? It's the game of sort of
cat and
who's gonna go first, cat and mouse. That's right, Bridgie.
Yeah. I try to. So, like, it didn't always work because there's a natural tendency, an urge to move. So when the closest someone gets to the ball, and like Thomas was saying, that you would be digesting all the information in front of you. I remember World Cup qualifier, we played against Japan in the last World Cup qualifying series in 2013 for the 14 World Cup. We played away in Japan, winning 1-0. Japan get a penalty. And I can't remember actually who was taking it, but I remember Holger Osiek saying to me, listen, if they get a penalty, he'll go, he's down on confidence, he's not playing well, and he always goes high down the middle. Always. So we watch the videos, and it's true. Like, so many times he went down the middle and high. So I'm thinking to myself, right, he's going high down the middle. And then all of a sudden, he runs up, and I just think he's going somewhere else, and I move. And he goes high down the middle. The manager goes berserk. I'm kicking myself. Because it was a given that he was going to go down the middle. But like I said to you, sometimes it was really hard to stop yourself from moving because the closer they get to the ball, there is a tendency to go, right, I've got to do something, I've got to move. So I tried to really work on standing still. So the key was always to not then fall on your heels, be on your toes. So standing still is one thing, but you've got to be able to react in a split second. So it's really, really tough. Of course it's tough because otherwise goalkeepers will be saving penalties left, right, and center, and they don't because it's such a tough art to try and not even master, nowhere near mastering it, but to be pretty decent at it.
And Swartz's had an advantage, Dave. He's got two long arms, he's got his long legs, and he's also got his nose. So if he goes one way, he can always turn his head. It was like an extra limb that he was able to put against the attacking players.
You should have scored more goals then, Bridget.
And knows where the back of the goal was, mate.
Yeah, but I think, you know, Dave, I think it doesn't matter. It all comes down to you're trying to influence the strikers. If you want to jump around on the line, you have to wave your arms. If you want to stand still, it's all about putting doubt into their mind. And as I said, there's different tactics, different strategies. And I think it comes down to what and works
the,
best for you.
The because, pressure of the moment as well, Tommy. Mm.
Yeah, no, I haven't been in 50 penalty shootouts, but I've, you know, the ones that I have been in, I had to work with myself. You have to calm yourself down, like Swartzy says, because it's easy to get caught up in the moment. You know, the energy is flowing. You want to save it. You know, it's a big opportunity as a goalkeeper to make a big impact on the game. And a lot of times you have to calm yourself down to then sort of remember the strategy and remember the tactics and remember what you, instead of being caught up in a moment and you know, and I, and I've done what Swartz have done as well. You know, you get caught up in it and then you go away from what you've, you know, what you know you should have been doing anyway. Mm.
I've had it like, you know, talk about the Uruguay penalty shootout in 2005 of 2005. And that was a very sort of a moment where I said to myself, okay, right, these guys, a lot of these guys, particularly South Americans, they like to stutter their run-ups. They like to wait for a goalkeeper to move early and then just calmly slot it another way. So it was about trying to stay on my feet as long as possible, because I felt with that sort of penalty taker, the majority of them were like that, was that the longer you sat on your feet, the closer they got to the ball, the more they're expecting you to move, the less you move, the more pressure is on them again, even more. Because then they're starting to panic a little bit, going, okay, right, now they've got to find a slot. The longer they wait, the more difficult it is for them to angle. And there's more of a chance that they will either miss or hit it closer to you. So that's where I always felt that you know, you had half a chance against teams like that. And obviously, I was able to stay on my feet long enough to make saves. And I think the fact that I sat on my feet as long as possible and didn't give anything away in terms of moving one way or the other. I did it one of the penalties I did it. I actually dived early and the rest of them I didn't. And I think that, you know, hugely contributed to making the saves.
Fascinating insight for our listeners. Hope you enjoyed that one as well. And maybe you will get some tips as opposed to me, and you can go on and save a few penalties at the park, as Bridgie suggested. Before we end that, one last thing, Bridgie, the overcoaching, the over-tactical, you know, we talk about people writing their own scripts in sport, but you've had managers who really try to write their scripts. We saw Gareth Southgate do it at the Euros. We saw David Moyes try it. Heck, we can go as far back to that shootout. What Schwartz, you referenced, what Mark, you've spoken about seeing Zeljko Kalac warm up in the corner of your eye with whatever Huss Hiddink was trying to do until Brett Emerton got cramp. We've seen Louis van Gaal do it with Tim Krul at the World Cup. What do you make of that, Bridgie? Like, surely it is, particularly we saw it with the Euros, it is the gamble of all gambles, isn't it?
Of course it is, and that's why they get paid the big bucks to make the big decisions. And if they come off like Tim Krul's did for the Netherlands, it was a stroke of genius. And if it doesn't, like Gareth Southgate has found out, like Moyes has found out now, it doesn't always happen. So that, you know, they're always thinking of ways. You never know. Noble might have been sitting on that bench there for the moments leading up to that penalty decision. They could have quickly gone, this is where De Gea goes. He goes more to this side. I know Tim Krul had a long time to study some of the penalty takers. When he came on and made a difference. I still think that I agree with the boys. Sometimes when you are not fit, you're not ready, you're not in the moment of the game, and you're coming on cold, and that's your first touch of the ball, I think it's a bit crazy, to be honest, and I thought Moyes might have learned from that. But Dave, who's to say there's no right or wrong in football? That is the joy of it. It's all about opinions, it's all about making decisions, and it's all about trying to find a difference that's going to give you the edge, and that hasn't. The one I'm looking forward to seeing is when Manchester United actually get a penalty for the first time, to see who's going to take that, and how Solskjaer, Fernandes and Ronaldo are going to handle that situation. There's another one.
No, I agree.
I think with the West Ham one and Mark Noble, I can so understand why David Moyes did what he did. Mark Noble's a really good penalty taker. He scored a lot of goals for West Ham, taken a lot of penalties and done well. So I can understand him. He's an experienced, their most experienced player. So it's not like what Gareth did and brought on young, inexperienced players who have the weight of the world on their shoulders. Mark Noble can handle it, and he's a West Ham boy through and through, and he's a captain of the club, or has been.
Well, he obviously can't handle it because he missed.
No, I know he missed, but it happens. We all know that it happens. And I don't think it was just because he came off the bench. You know, I think if he scores it, everyone goes, of course you bring him on, because he's such a good penalty taker, and he's their general penalty taker. So I think it's whenever you miss, people, it opens up for criticism.
So I've got to say, when he came on and he was wanting to take that penalty, I'm watching the game, and I mean, my wife doesn't even like watching football, but I made her, and I was saying, he's going to miss. She went, this is like what happened with England. She was straight away on it. And I understand what you were saying. I did say, he has got the best record. He's Mr. Reliable. He's the leader of the football club. He's been there a long time, but it just stunk. I did not like seeing it. I thought it was disrespectful to the players that were on the field.
10 penalties from maybe. 10 for him. I can see Thomas wants to jump in. Yep.
Yeah, no, I bet Solskjaer wished he had put Henderson in the Europa League final now. But I like the thinking. You know, I think like Swartzy, you know, he's the best taker. So it gives you a reason to put him on. Hindsight is always easy. And it didn't work. And you take the criticism. And I think Moisey stood up after the game as well and said, you know what, it's on me. I stand by my decision and fair play. Mm.
He's come out and said he's the best penalty. He's actually come out and said he's the best penalty taker in Europe. Mm. That's what he's actually said. Obviously, it's an emotional thing and trying to justify it all, but he is a very good penalty taker. Mm. So I get that. I get why he's done it. It hasn't worked out, but I understand why he did it. And I wouldn't be surprised if he did it again.
You're only as good as your last penalty.
Of course. I wouldn't be surprised if he did it again.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Norwich, Thomas, they're in a bit of bother. The Watford game was one they would have had penciled in, saying they had to get something from it, but they've now lost all five games. Daniel Farke overnight has given some comments. He said, I think it's always important to be honest, but also not to bury them alive, and it's important to stay positive. I want to go to you. I know you've had experience with Sunderland when the tide is going against you. What do Norwich do now? Can they arrest this tide of momentum?
You know, I think it comes down to, you know, Farke doesn't seem to want to change you know, his tactics, and I think they've now been exposed, and we saw especially, you know, Watford down the flanks. I think that the space they leave when they go forward, you know, just get torn to threads in all the games they played up until now, And again, have they got a defense that they can just shut up shop and play a little bit more like Burnley and grind out result? So I don't think so. And then you've got the whole, you know, the mental aspect of and you know, like you said, I can dig into my experiences. You know, when you start losing, you start questioning everything around you. You start questioning the manager, the tactics, your teammates, yourself. And the more you lose, it becomes a habit, and it's sort of a snowballing effect. It's just it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and I think that's eventually, Timo Pukki can't single-handedly dig them out. You know, he scores from time to time, and you know, he's fairly efficient, but they're leaking way too many goals, and I think, you know, the mental side of it, you know, is all. Already the cracks are already starting to appear.
The worrying sign for me with Norwich, Dave, is the fact that a team that has come up with them in Watford has, you know, annihilated them. I thought it was a tremendous performance from them. And like Tommy says, they've been exposed in so many areas. The boy Saw, I thought, was fantastic with his two goals for Watford, the way that he did. And they controlled the game. But not only that, they actually bullied and dominated all over the park. When I see Hanley and Quebec in the defence, young Aarons and Williams at the back, Gilmore's a great player in the defensive, in the midfield, you know what quality is. But do they really have the power and the presence that, you know, when the things are going against you, you've got to roll your sleeves up. And sometimes you've got to grind results up, and that maybe that is, you know, what Tommy's saying about Farker, he's not going to change his ways. But a lot of teams like your Burnleys will hang on. They'll look for set players because they know they're dominant. They've got an aerial presence. I don't even see that in Norwich. They're a very, very small team. They look like they're an easy beat. And I think it's curtains for them. I'll make a massive statement here. I know Swindon, and we've suffered it with Sunderland, have gone down and got relegated, unfortunately. I think Norwich could go down this season with the least amount of points by any Premier League team. There you go. They look that,
I don't think they're that bad. I don't think they're that bad. I don't think they're that bad as Derby were back then. But
what's Derby's points?
The thing is, right?
Was it nine or 11?
No, I thought it was 11.
I'll look it up.
They're going to be in around the mix, I'm telling you.
Norwich, there's no... the only thing I'm surprised with is there's no bounce. There's not been a momentum from the Championship, that promotion. I thought maybe there'd be a little bit of a better fight and they haven't had it. But listen, did any of us think that Norwich is going to stay up? No. I certainly never thought Norwich was going to stay up.
I hope they'd learn from the last time, Schwartzy. I hope they'd have
Yeah, but I don't think they haven't, because they haven't signed players.
Yeah.
But that's not their model, though, is it? Their model is to be that club that's up and down, up and down. Obviously, the outside chance of potentially staying in the league. But if you look at their signings in Ozan Kabak, Billy Gilmore on loan, Josh Sargent from Schalke, the American... just to name the three of them, you know. I mean, we saw Ozan Kabak a bit last season at Liverpool. He's a shadow of himself. He had high expectations on his shoulders, but he was at Schalke for, what, 2-3 seasons, and they were diabolical. The guy is completely zero in confidence. At Liverpool, struggled to adjust. And at Norwich, his confidence is not going to be improved upon. Billy Gilmore's a good player. There's no doubt about it. He's got game time to develop. In a good team, of course, and he'll do all right, but it won't be enough for Norwich to stay up. And you look at Josh Sargent, you know, he's just an okay player. He's a young player, inexperienced at the Premier League, and was a bit part player in the Bundesliga as well. And then you take Watford as the example. As you said, you know, Watford have been promoted. Josh King, Danny Rose, and Sissoko. I mean, the three players that... Yeah,
they've kept a hold of Saul. I thought Saul might have gone when they left because he was brilliant in the Premier League.
Exactly. So you've got three players they've brought into the club that have got enormous amount of Premier League experience, are still more than capable of playing in the Premier League and doing well in the Premier League, adding to an already experienced squad. Watford are always fancy to do all right. So they're chalk and cheese in terms of comparison. Norwich has their model. They run at a very, very tight ship. The money they get for promotion is reinvested in the academy. They develop players. Their aim is to ship them on. And they hope for a bit of success along the way. They're not going to get it. We know that.
And you think they're selling Buendia, who was one of their best players from last year, sell him to Villa. So that's a statement right there.
Exactly. Exactly, before the season begins. I mean, they've got 30 million for him, but it's not like, I mean, I know for Norwich, that's a lot of money, but still, is that worth to sell one of your best players before the season even begins that you've been promoted in the Premier League? You know, obviously for Norwich, that's a statement.
Yeah, and you look at what Tony is doing at Brentford, you know, a similar situation. They could
Let's talk about Brentford because of the contrast. I mean, they've been a breath of fresh air. And I know, obviously, they started the season with the win against Arsenal. Took a while to get another one, but they did on the weekend. And they look like they're going to be super, super competitive.
So can I just dive 100%. In there? And this is going back to us about Norwich. They look like easy beats, yeah? Brentford don't. They've got a formula. They've got a style of play, which you've got to admire under Frank. I think he's been brilliant and the way that they have kept hold of Tony. But what they have got, when they went down to 10 men against Wolves, they've got the grit and steel. They've got Janssen at the back, who's an absolute nightmare. He loves to wind up the opposition. He winds up the opposition fans. He was playing mind games towards the end going down. The other boy, Ayer at the back, was that the boy that came from Celtic?
Yep.
Again, another strong, powerful defender that I feel has made his presence felt. And they've got some quality on the ball. I think that they've got something that I didn't feel would keep them in the division. But after watching them, I don't think they're going to have a problem this season because of the way that they are able to mix it up. And when they needed to defend in numbers, they did. And they looked very, very comfortable doing it.
They work. I mean, from top to bottom, they work incredibly hard. And you look at Ivan Toney as well. Like, we talk about him as being their star player, the most important player. But the work rate that he puts in, the work every one of them put in, is very impressive. It's always with these teams, you kind of go, right, okay, how long can you do that? Can you do it for the entirety of the season? Will it be enough to stay out? I said it as well at the beginning of the season. I think Brentford have got a decent chance of staying out. Absolutely.
So the record points that we mentioned for Derby was 11 points. There was the Brentford's win was against Wolves 2-0 on the weekend, which you mentioned that 9:30 Saturday night that was. And Norwich, the only caveat would be that their fixtures have included Liverpool, Manchester City, Leicester and Arsenal. But the manner of the defeats, you would imagine, and also the fact that the Watford game was the one they needed a hit and they could not. But another bright spark in the competition, if we're going to talk about Brentford, before we get onto the heavyweights, has to be Brighton, Bridgie. Because up in fourth, ahead of Manchester City, we're starting to finally see some goals as the reward for the play that we've been praising them on for, 18 months under Graham Potter, and a 2-1 win over Leicester. Bit of luck involved in that win with penalties going in their favour, both in terms of what they got and what Leicester did not get, but they got the win.
Well, it was penalties. There was the VAR offsides that also helped them when they were, we've got two goalkeepers on the show. They know how awkward it is when you get a striker standing in front of you when there's them set players coming to try and just block your vision. But you've got to say, Brighton and Potter, the way that they have gone about their business is absolutely brilliant. Duncan Duffy at the back looked solid in the game. Lallana, great to see him performing. Welbeck, another player that we, I just think after his injuries, great to see him back. And still that question mark, have they got the number nine or the strike that's going to get them then 20 plus goals to keep them around? Mapai gets the penalty, takes it. Trossard impressed with March. I just think each year these players grow in confidence with the Premier League experience that they have. The way Potter is able to get his messages across, and no wonder there's so many teams wanting to get him. But again, it's a club that have set out their stall. The reason they got Potter in to fit the club's style of play, the philosophy they were after, and they're reaping the benefits, mate. And I'm really, really impressed with them. Still question the number nine situation going on, but they could be the big shock that nobody picked out this season that can perform. You were after an underdog, and I didn't see these coming.
Four wins out of five. They've beaten Burnley, they've beaten Watford, they've beaten Brentford, and they've beaten Leicester. They've lost to Everton. But if you're picking up at Brighton's level, if you're picking up those wins, that holds you in good stead for your campaign to accumulate the points you need to be to where you want to be. So well done to Graham Potter and to Brighton. It's good to see a different team up amongst the pack. But not in first place. Not in first place. That's where Chelsea sit at the moment, gents, after that impressive, particularly second half. It's taken me a while to get there. I thought I'd just warm up. Just
the smile up, is back on his face. The smile.
Just warm it up. We've talked about goalkeepers. We've talked about Chelsea. We're very happy today. It's a very, very biased podcast. But yeah, that was Schwartzy, a very impressive second half. What do you take more out of this game? How impressive Tuchel's switch was to make that second half with Chelsea just running right over Tottenham, or the manner in which Tottenham collapsed? Which is the biggest story for you?
Tottenham collapsing is no real surprise, I have to say. I'm not joking. I just don't... Tottenham have been on the down, on the dwindle for a while. I said it before, I don't think Nuno's the right man for Spurs, certainly for inspiration, for a team that certainly looks jaded. The Harry Kane saga, we all know, we've talked about it so many times. We're going to talk it to death before the end of the season anyway, certainly before January. The thing about Chelsea, I think that the one thing I would take from that game that impressed me the most was the way that Thomas Tuchel made the change at halftime, wasn't afraid to make a change, but not only that, right? A lot of managers make those changes, right? But I was more impressed with the response. So, I mean, we saw Azpilicueta come out after the game and said that he gave the team a dressing down at halftime. And we've all been in dressing rooms where managers have done that, lost their cool. You've been a bad performance in the first half. And so often
me and Tommy played under Peter Reid. We've seen that. Don't worry. We know exactly what half times are like.
So, and more often than not, though, the performance continues. It may lift for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but then it kind of fizzles out as well. And you end up on the back of a bad result, right? I'm just impressed with the way that Tuchel has managed the squad. And I've said it right from the beginning when he took over and how he brought all the older experienced players together. I mean, Marcos Alonso is a great example, right? He was going, he was gone. How many times has he been leaving the club? Even in the summer, apparently he was leaving, or he was for sale. but out in the cold. And Marcus Alonso has been so important to him. He looks a different player. He certainly plays well under the formation as well. But I think for me, it's the way in which Thomas Tuchel's formed relationship with his entire squad. I mean, Timo Werner, he's a player that really could easily be sulking. You know, I mean, I know he hasn't warranted necessarily starting, but the price tag, everything else, manager believing in him, he's left him out. He comes on. He's like, I was thinking about it. He could actually replace Mason Mount and play as that creative player. I think he's good enough, Timo Werner, to do that. But, you know, I just think the response from the players, every player that comes on, no one looks like they're moping. No one looks like they're disgruntled. Everyone wants to be part of it. And I think when you see a squad of that too many top quality players who desperately want to be part of it, they know they're onto something special. Mm. And the manager, I like everything about him. I just think he looks a bit scary. When he talks, you're thinking, mate, he's going to give you a bollocking. But he's obviously got so much respect and obviously the players have all bought into him. And so far, there's very little you could even criticise him on, if at all, anything.
And Lukaku was meant, the story was meant to be Lukaku against Kane, and then in Thiago Silva, who was phenomenal, and Antonio Rudiger scoring, Chelsea have their 9th and 10th scorers of the season. So it's a nice compliment to have where the goals aren't all funneling through the club record signing that you brought in to make all those solutions. Bridgie, Spurs and Nuno. So Schwartzy touched on it, saying that Nuno wasn't the right man. Most of the conversation around the weekend has been about Harry Kane's body language. I've read a few pieces trying to explain the way he was used and the logic behind it. But at the end of the day, Harry Kane being stationed out on the left, do you stomach that or not?
Oh, no, not at all. Now, the first few games, what I've got to say, the dynamics without Harry Kane, when Nuno plays his style, the counter-attack that we saw at Wolves, get numbers behind the ball and then try and counter-attack. I think when Son was there, Bergwijn was there, Moore was there, it worked absolutely brilliantly because you had three very, very dynamic and fast players that could catch teams on the counter-attack. Now, injuries and suspensions haven't helped. Emerson Royale's coming at right back. Tanganga's had to go centre-half. He got suspended. Romeo comes in. The back line is just looking very, very disjointed at this moment in time. They don't know. There's too many changes having to be made there in the back four. The midfield, Højbjerg, are really, really rate, but the other week was Skip was in there. I'm trying to think who else. Harry Winks. And I just thought, God, this is just so one-dimensional. There's no X factor. So Dele Alli and Ndombele were in there against Chelsea. They looked like they were underdone. And Harry Kane out in that position, I just didn't enjoy it. His body language was terrible. He hasn't got the pace for me to play that system when he's got Son, Lo Celso and Harry Kane. They haven't got the pace that was early on. So Nuno is getting found out with the players at his disposal. And I've got to say, Schwartzy never thought I would say this. If Harry Kane is not going to play as the number nine, and he's not going to play him as the out-and-out striker, he's got to be dropped. And he's got to not play him if he wants to carry on with these dynamics, because that system and way that he was playing...
So what's the difference?
What do you mean?
What's the difference between Harry Kane playing for England and Harry Kane playing for Spurs in terms of where he plays Harry Kane, how he drops off? I said it during the Euros, and you pretty much put me down about it, saying that I think Harry Kane's underutilised. And he certainly is underutilized at Spurs right now, playing out wide. With England, he's underutilized by dropping in the half.
The main number nine, get him in around the area where he scores
absolutely
goals.
And absolutely, that's what I'm saying. I said that about England. I said that's what they don't do with him, and I don't get it. I don't understand it. He's one of the best goal scorers on the planet, and you have him dropping deep for England, or you have him playing out wide for Spurs. I mean, it's like, I don't know, Nuno's probably seen something that no one else on the planet has actually seen. And maybe he thinks playing him out wide, he's going to actually become even a better goal scorer.
Well, he looked lethargic. He looked underdone. I think, obviously, I don't know where his headspace is. I never thought I'd say that about Harry Kane. But he, obviously, in that position,
You understand it. I understand.
Of course
I do. I understand where he is.
I'd be gutted if I didn't get me move. Gutted.
But also, I'm just calling Johnny Aloisi to kick off that debate again. Hang on, one second.
No, what I am saying,
exactly. He's seen all the trophies slip away now. Like you've got hopes. He's obviously settled to stay there for at least for 6 months, and he can see that he's going to be nowhere near even maybe a top four if he's going to stay. And where does that leave him?
This is not just about Harry Kane. What I will say, we're talking about the manager and Nuno. I've got to say, I think the dynamics worked early on. So if I compare this, going into this weekend's game against Tottenham, right, we've got North London Derby. Arsenal had a shocking start to this season. Arteta had to deal with injuries. He had to deal with players struggling with the flu symptoms and things like that. And he didn't know what his best back four was. Now, since he's gone with Gabriel and White and Tierney, they've got the stability at the back. The last two games have kept clean sheets. He's got the players back. Aubameyang's back down the centre. Partey's in the defensive midfield. He's got all these players back at his disposal and they're looking good. And it's almost flipped on Nuno. Now he's got to deal with the injury crisis, but not knowing what his best team is. So going into this one at the weekend, I fear for Tottenham. I'm going to say that Arsenal will get the result because of the form that they are in at this current time. And it's almost like somebody's just gone and flipped it completely upside down.
So, Thomas, one thing I heard Tim Sherwood say it, I heard Glenn Hoddle say it, and I know that Spurs have been quite reactive up until the weekend. Then they tried to go proactive to start the game. They ran out of gas. Now, I'm here in my little, you know, bubble on the other side of the world. I've never played that elite football. I don't understand the idea that 5 weeks into the season, a Premier League side can be called they're not fit enough to execute a game plan. Can you explain that to me? Because that is ultimately, for all the stuff that you guys have said, I find that unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't think that's an excuse because, if that's the excuse, then it's, huge negligence from management and the physical trainers, because that's what you have. Like, we got to understand the machine of a Premier League club. Like, you've got physical trainers, you've got people in the weight room, you've got physio, you've got all the things that is needed to implement your game plan. And all this that Nuno hasn't had enough time, he's still sort of, he hasn't been there for years. But we saw what Tuchel, came in and did, what Lampard was doing and what Tuchel did. And that was, if not overnight, but it was within a couple of weeks. So there's something that he isn't doing. And we got to look at, I think it was brave what they did in the start of the game. But like what Chelsea has showed, like, you got to score. And they had a couple of chances, a couple of half chances. But then you got to be able to then adjust to that. And we saw in the second half that Chelsea adjusted and Tottenham just fell apart. And but fitness, no excuse whatsoever in my book.
I don't think Tottenham are unfit. You look at Nuno's teams at Wolves, none of them were undercooked. None of them were not fit. They are all fit. Right, they would run, they'd work hard. They were a fit side, so for me that's not the problem. I think it's already a case of that group of players, and you guys will know the same. You come in, you got a manager, you got a tactic, and you see the team not performing, not doing it, you're not buying into the manager, whatever it is, and morale drops, everything drops. You become fatigued, you become lethargic, everything about it. And the minute something goes against you, everything drops, your heads drop. And I think that's Spurs at the moment. There is a complete problem with the morale in that squad. And that starts from the top all the way down to the bottom. And obviously Harry Kane is always going to be the first person people are going to mention because of the failed attempt to get out of the club. But it's bigger than that.
Swartz, do you think they're still sulking with Pochettino going? And they've gone through Mourinho defensive, Nuno.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think it's Pochettino. No, I don't think it's Pochettino. You know what it's like as players. Yeah, of course you look back and go, I wish we kept so-and-so. I wish we slim as a manager. But you don't continuously sulk because a manager's left. What you're doing is you're going, okay, all right, who are you bringing in instead? And then you look at it and you go, okay, does he even come close to what we had? Are we going to get better under this manager? Are we going to progress? Are we going to have any chance of winning something? And then you look at it, and I think Spurs, even if they, even if you look at the first three games of the season, yeah, they were tough. I mean, Man City's performance was a good performance, right?
It was outstanding.
Absolutely. Yeah. They worked incredibly hard. It worked to a T. the actual.
But Nuno done that with Wolves against Man City in the past as well. So he had the game plan absolutely. Down pat.
Absolutely. So that worked fantastically, right? But Spurs are not Wolves.
right? So you look at a Spurs side who want to play attractive football. They demand it. The fans demand it. Everything demands about, and the way the team is set up is that they're there to play some decent football. Yes, you've got to play to your strengths. I just don't believe that. I think the players already have doubts about the manager.
But Sporty, this is my argument. In them first few games, Son, Bergvall, Moura on the counter attack in the transition moments, it suited Spurs down at the ground. The three games that they were won. Once the injuries have hit and Harry Kane's got to come back into that side, and you know the Lo Celso is not the same player. The dynamics of that system and the tactics is absolutely diluted. So he's got to come up with a different formula to suit the players at his disposal, because it works when he has the players that he had early on in the season. Now he's got a complete loss and he's got to fit Harry Kane in there somewhere. And for me, it doesn't work unless he's playing as that nine and he's got three fast players around him.
Absolutely. So that's the key.
Yeah, but also I agree with you, Schwartz. I think it stems from high up, and I think we see it, history tells us. Like, we look at Arsenal, we look at, the ownership, we look at Tottenham. I think the decisions that, Levy and other people in that boardroom have made has not served the club well. I question if Nuno, it's a Mourinho 2.0, and did Mourinho work? No, so I question you. We can always go down to the players and say, ultimately, they're on the pitch. They're the ones that has to win games, and the manager as well. But over time, decisions made by ownership has a huge influence.
Go back to that Mourinho situation, right? So, I mean, we talked about it in the previous podcast. You sack him 6 days before a cup final. That's what you brought him in for. You brought him in to win silverware. So that's a decision from above. I mean, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It didn't make any sense then. And it doesn't make any sense today. So
debate over. You've just nailed it, boys. You've nailed it. The problem is rooted deeper than what it is to the players on the park.
Wasn't Nuno brought in for his attacking philosophy and desire to bring youth in? Wasn't that what Daniel Levy promised? I'm kidding. That's what he promised.
I was about to jump on you there.
Can we move on?
Thomas, you thought what? Who? What's he talking about?
Can we move on? Chelsea won 3-0. Yeah, I think you're going to do the quadruple or the treble. Well done. Let's move on.
The only thing there is if Tottenham want any, fans want any hope, you can only look down the road, where we sat here 2 weeks ago saying if Mikel Arteta does not watch over an Arsenal side that beats Norwich, he will be sacked. They've won 2 from 2 since then. They have to beat Norwich and Burnley, the Arsenal, but they have. And now the momentum has completely changed. Bridgie, you've said you think this is going to be Arsenal's game. What about you two other boys on the weekend? Is this going to... Because remember as well, for manager of the month in August for Nuno, they lose 2-0 in this game. They go below Arsenal on the table. So
we love football, don't we?
Yeah. It moves quickly.
No, but I think, you've put on the run sheet highs and lows from the weekend. I think
that run sheet's gone. We've blown that out of the water.
Arsenal, I think they were one of them. It's a tough place to go. We've questioned... the spine, the resilience, and to go to Burnley and, to grind out a result. I think it's a step in the right direction. Are they fluent, amazing to watch at the moment? Possibly not, but you've got to start somewhere. And I think that obviously, Bridgie, I think you mentioned, some of the players that have come back. I think Gabriel at the back and we've got to give, Ramsdale a bit of credit, 2 clean sheets as well in goal. So that was a big decision to drop Leno. Mm-hmm.
Gabriel and White look the best centre partnership out of the lot. And it's proved that. He changed it 3 times in 3 matches. Last 2 games, he stuck with it. The players understand their roles, Tommy. Totally agree.
Yeah, and Odegaard, I think, has also made a difference. So, we got to give them time. And I think it's another big test against Tottenham. They're what direction you want your season to take. I think that game has huge importance. So I can't wait for it.
What about Chelsea against Manchester City? We've got it taken a while to get into Manchester City. 0-0 against Southampton. It's pretty hard to fathom. Southampton were incredible in the amount of effort and energy they put into that game to get that 0-0 result. But this is 6 weeks into the season, 9:30 p.m. Saturday night. Schwartzy, I know it's early in the week, so it's a bit early to be previewing it, but off the back of everything we've spoken about, this is just such a massive game. And geez, Manchester City have a bit of work to do to improve and match Chelsea's levels.
They do, absolutely. And let's not forget, Thomas Tuchel has it over Pep Guardiola, doesn't he? He has something over him. He knows how to beat his sides. It's not a one-sided game. It's not a – you can't write Manchester City off. Yes, they're having problems up front. Were they lacking the weekend? Incredibly. I don't get the decision about overturning the penalty decision. I totally get the decision about the red card because it was a mistake from the referee, John Mosh, to give a penalty and a red card because it's double jeopardy. It can't happen anymore. So that makes sense to me. Was it a clear and obvious mistake? I don't think so. I mean, I think they're the decision that could be a penalty, not a penalty, right? So Man City's season could have been far worse. Certainly the game could have been far worse for them. But you don't write them off. I mean, Chelsea, yes, on form, you look at it. It's like saying what you're saying there, Bridgie was saying about Arsenal being favourites against Tottenham, fancy Arsenal. In all the derbies, you can never go into it thinking that one just because on their form is going to necessarily win it. I always find that the derbies, you can throw form out the window and it depends. You know, you'll see with Spurs, that they'll show up. On paper, Spurs for me are a better side than Arsenal. On paper. That's one thing, you know. But
even with the injuries and suspension that Spurs have got at this moment in time?
Yeah, even with that, I still think they're a better side than Arsenal. It's just they're not playing anywhere near it at the moment. They're not showing it, you know. With Chelsea, Chelsea is certainly playing a lot better than Manchester City at the moment. And Manchester City they're already paying for not bringing an out-and-out striker. I mean, you know, Pep said it himself, you know, it was my mistake, you know, I should have brought in another striker, and he hasn't. I mean, I'd like to see him after the Champions League final come out and say I made a mistake by not playing Rodri or
Fernandinho.
Geez, what's his name?
He is more stubborn than my wife.
Or Rodri, yeah. But what I'm saying, you know, he admits he's made a mistake about the not bringing a striker, which, you know, he can't do anything about, and it's kind of out of his hands. But with the final, it was in his hands to make the right decision. And it's the only game all season he leaves out one of his defensive holding midfield. Anyway, I'm digressing a little bit. But, you know, Man City are potentially still could turn it around in an instant.
I still think Chelsea will be 5 points clear of City after they get this win.
On that note of Pep saying I was wrong, was he wrong with what he said about the fans, or has he been wildly taken on a media ride? Because if you remember, what he was calling for was for fans to come to Southampton on the weekend where they needed a bit more energy. And in the end, he was actually right about that. But the whole thing has become Pep against the fans, and that's become a massive distraction at the same time.
It was the same media. He was being put through that, and that was about obviously his tactics, and you know, has his time, you know, been found out, and you know, can he renew himself and all this, and you know, the papers are looking for it in a good manner. I don't think he was in what he said, and it sort of get turned into a bit of a him versus the fans, and which I don't think it was ever the intention. And, you know, the fans love him, and well, they'll keep loving him.
It's like you say, Tommy did make that previously. I've heard him, I think it was last season or the year before, again, crying out for fans to come to the stadium for one of their games in Europe. And, you know, it's definitely come from up above. He's got sucked in by somebody at the club saying we need to get some more bums on seats. I don't think he's bothered how many people turn up, as long as his team are performing. And I feel for him, he's got sucked into this bit of crap that he doesn't need.
All right, Bridgie's gone Chelsea. You are the two?
I would hope Man City, just to spice it up a little bit. you know, also for this sort of bad run, that you know, their bad form against Chelsea, just to, you know, to give Pep one back and just to, yeah, just put a little bit of doubt in Tuchel's mind. I think that would be good for the league.
Shorty?
Well, would it be good for the league? No, it wouldn't be good. It'd be great for Chelsea.
Oh, come on.
I obviously want Chelsea to win. But by the same token, I don't want to see it be a one-team race throughout the course of the season. We don't want to see Liverpool or a Man City of a couple of seasons ago running away with it. You want to see a tight, even. I think we want to. What I really want to see is I want to see a really hotly contested title right down the wire, which then Chelsea win.
Stop sitting on the fence. Who's going to win this game?
I've just said Man City.
Yeah, I'm on about Sporty.
Okay.
Chelsea's going
to
win.
Chelsea, right. Good man. Yeah. So here's one for you. If Man City lose to Chelsea this weekend, then they lose to Liverpool the weekend after, are they out the title race?
No, not at all.
How low they were after eight matches last week.
Even if they go 8 points behind you, right? Okay, fair enough. Maybe I'm looking too far ahead.
So many games to go. There's so many games to go. They've done it before in the past, and they're more than capable of doing it again. Wait until January as well. January is a big month for so many reasons. Obviously, if the African nations go ahead as well, Liverpool are going to lose Mane and Salah.
That's good. How do you compensate for that?
Well, you don't. So that's going to be a big month. Then Manchester City, do they go out and buy a striker? Do they go and spend the money then in January? That may well happen. So I think there's a big month coming up in January, big moment of the season where, you know, could really change things.
And you even look at, you mentioned the title race being, you know, Chelsea potentially running, going 5 points clear. Don't forget how tight it is with Manchester United and Liverpool. Manchester United play Aston Villa at the same time as Chelsea against Manchester City. And then later on in the night, Liverpool go to Brentford. It's 2:30 a.m. Sunday morning, of course, before, you know, 24 hours later, your week starts on Monday, 1:30 a.m. with the North London Derby. So a bit early in the week to be thinking about next week, but geez, there's a lot to look forward to.
But there's genuinely four, if not five, teams that are potentially going to win the league. I mean, even if Chelsea do go 5 points ahead of Manchester City, it's irrelevant at this stage. I mean, it's great to be in that position, of course. But, I mean, Liverpool, Man United, Man City, Chelsea, any one of those four are going to win the league, I believe. I don't think there's anyone. I said four to five. I think it's four. I think it's out of those four teams. And I think that's what makes it exciting this season, is that genuinely any one of those four teams can win it.
Yeah, agree.
Totally. Hey, one last one before we end off. It's a quirky one to end off with, and it's been a riveting damn chat as ever, guys. But I want to take you to Germany because I know, Schwarzer, you're very keen on this one. And it's Julian Nagelsmann. This just came out of left field during the week, where he said, "American football is much more technologically advanced than our football. The quarterback has an earpiece to his coach. We absolutely need that. Football must stop hiding behind tradition and revolutionize itself." You want earpieces to your managers in your ears and goals? You might go mad.
No, I think it's a lot of rubbish. I mean, I think any of these suggestions, it's a bit like, again, I'm going to digress a little bit, Arsene Wenger saying have the World Cup every 2 years. What we need is debate. We need to have a conversation about how we can improve the game, put things out there, have a conversation about it. But I don't think it's for football. I really don't. Putting an earpiece in players' ears, no. I think American football is one thing. It's had to find ways of being innovative. This is the only place in the world that plays it.
How much easier is it to put an earpiece in a helmet as opposed to putting an earpiece in an ear, and you get a ball kicked at your ear and the earpiece ends up going into the side of your skull? Seriously?
But also there's fundamental, you know, where the quote is totally off is that there's fundamental differences between the games where, you know, I'm a big American football fan and, you know, it's a stop start. It's play by play. So you have to give instructions between every play where football is. I think Nagelsmann has been playing too much FIFA. I think he wants the joystick out there and controlling the players. I think that's his problem.
Can you imagine that, Tommy? I'm thinking myself as an attacking player and I'm going up against a 1v1 situation. I've got the Nagelsmann here. Do the Maradona spin turn. Do a step over. I'm like, oh God.
Could you imagine about that, having that attempt for players to express themselves? That goes out the window. You just become mechanical.
So here's one for you, just to finish off on this whole debate about me and Tommy played under Peter Reid. The last thing I would want is Peter Reid with an earpiece in my ear so I could hear what he was saying. There was another guy in the A-League was Gary Van Egmont. Gary Van Egmont commentated the whole game. He shouted and bawled at everybody, and it was absolutely brilliant because me and Ryan Griffiths would go and stand on the opposite side of the field away from the bench just so we couldn't hear him. And Griff was actually playing on the right wing at the time, and he came and played left wing, and he was like, I've got to get away from him. So if you put an earpiece in me with managers like that, no thank you, mate.
No, but how would it be? You could say it wasn't working. You could be like,
Could you imagine? Like, I mean, you only have him as a manager, right? I play with Gary Van Egmont. I had him as a teammate. Him and John Paul De Marini. Can you imagine having those two
in your side at the same time. I mean, like, honestly, the two of them, Jesus, they would not stop.
You could have two earpieces, one in each of them.
Oh, my God. I mean, listen, I mean, the fiery characters. And Mr. Squiggle was his nickname, Gary Van Egmont. So,
no way.
Yeah. It was his nickname.
Oh, that's outstanding.
So, 5 years too late on that, yeah. Luigi. That would have been good intel.
That would have been a good one, intel. I'll score. Don't worry. Yeah. I'll get that around Newcastle.
Exactly.
But Dave, just to be serious about
bring
it.
Bring back to us to end the podcast,
yeah,
please,
no,
Tom.
Tommy, please.
I think fundamentally, you know, you got to look at other sports. You got to try to obviously invent. When we were, you know, Schwarzer gave a fantastic talk about, you know, obviously what FIFA is trying to do with the World Cup and what Wenger is doing to try to, you know, reinvent the game. And I sort of get where he's coming from. I know a lot of the coaches go to America and study the training methods, the, you know, all the video equipment and all these things. But I think this is, you know, I think this comment has gone a little bit too far. I don't think it would ever work in football like we've just talked about.
And managers are always coming up with ideas, Dave. And, you know, Gareth Southgate for England, when he went over to check out the NBA and how they actually make that little yard of space to get that free player to get a shot into the basket when there's a clinical moment. So he went and analysed that just to get the blocking situation going. You know, things like that work when you can put it into a place in your industry, in your game. And he saw that from set players. He wanted to work on different things. And we saw that in the World Cup, how England was so dynamic from that situation. So that's something where you can go, yes, he's thought about it, he's taken it, and he's thought, how can I put this into our game? With the Nagelsmann one, I understand the love technology, the want to have this, how can we find the biggest pockets of space? That's the latest thing that people are trying to do. They've got all these top gurus from around the world trying to come up with a system which I've seen fundamentally work, and where it always shows and highlights the biggest pockets of space on the field at one moment in time. And I mean, that is unbelievable technology. But to think about wearing an earpiece in a game, I think it's very, very dangerous. And I thought it was a silly comment from such an inspiring manager.
I actually think it'd be not only for those reasons, for all those reasons, I agree with you, but also you'd lose all the tantrums on the sideline from the managers. They wouldn't be as anywhere near as animated or anything like that. It would be so boring watching them sitting in a box or sitting on the bench and not even actually breaking a sweat because they'd be just talking down an earpiece. Nah,
yeah, but you'd love to see one of them throw the walkie-talkie or throw the earpiece down at the player as it listened to him, because, you know, he's got no excuse then. I tell you what, the only thing I'll say is someone like Nagelsmann, to have got to where he's got to in his 20s and now obviously in his early 30s, he's always been a step ahead. So it's really interesting to see how far ahead he is thinking in terms of his innovation, because for him to get to where he's
Well, he's renowned for it, isn't he? He's renowned for it in Germany. Yeah, he was renowned for it in Germany. And hence the reason, obviously, he's got to where he has in such a short period of time. So highly regarded. And listen, we talked about it earlier on, I think, about the way that Nagelsmann has started his time at Bayern. Pre-season didn't win a single game. And since then, you know, they've come into the Bundesliga and their timing has been perfect and they've been brilliant.
Just to give you an insight of what I've been doing at the Edgeworth Eagles, Mr. Wiener, a few of the players have been wearing GPS units, and what I've done with one of the players, he gave the ball away so many times, I put in a little one of these dog zapping things that you can do to train your dogs, and I put it, and every time he gave the ball away, I'd press it.
You did
give
it.
Him an electric
really done
shock.
That?
No, I didn't, mate, but I really
That's
wanted
brilliant.
To. I was
did.
Thinking ahead of the game every time. So if he gives a ball away, he's going to get an electric shock. So there you go. There's ways we can try and implicate things, but I didn't have the courage to do that one as yet.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Gents, well, you mentioned the Bundesliga, Schwarzer. We've had that on the rundown for the last 3 weeks, but we've talked so much about all these other interesting topics. We will get to it at some point, but my goodness, lots to talk about as ever. Thank you for your time, guys. Great to see you as ever. Bridgie, you'll be on Premier League today on Optus Sport at 7 p.m. Tuesday. If you're listening to this before that, crossing into the UK, look forward to seeing that. And the two of you will look forward to chatting next time. Been great fun as always. And yeah, brilliant insights. Love every second.
Great debate, lads. Thanks for the insight on the penalties. Dave Wiener and myself thoroughly enjoyed that.
I'm going
Good
to the garden
as
now.
Always,
I'm
guys.
I'm going to kick the ball against the wall and try and save him and outsmart myself.
Enjoy.
Cheers, guys. To everyone out there, as ever, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did today. And until the next episode of the Gagan Pod, enjoy your football.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.